iOS apps that track you and sell your location to third parties. The problems with the EU's new copyright directive, what Jason Snell from Macworld thinks of the new Apple Watch, and how to make money selling toothpaste from a backpack. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 49, recorded Thursday, September 13th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CashFly. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network. For a complimentary, detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends, visit twit.cashfly.com. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news of the week. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell.
So whether you download a free app on Android or iOS, it is always a good idea to consider where they might be getting their money from. Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica says many apps these days are paying their bills by tracking your location and then selling it, even when they don't have to. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Hey, great to be here.
So you first learned of this this tracking and sharing while prepping for a talk at DEF CON. Tell us about that.
Right. So Dave Porcello, formerly of Pony Express, and I did a project about 4 years ago where we dropped a Dropbox in the house of an NPR reporter and watched all of his network traffic for a week or so to see what we could tell just from his network traffic. And so we wanted to recreate that a little bit and do a workshop for people at DEF CON on how to look for privacy leaks in their network traffic. So I used Wireshark, which is a utility that's a graphic utility that lets you look at packet captures in depth. And Dave used a bunch of command line tools, and we went through and showed people how to look for pieces of information that might be leaking out into your regular internet traffic that hadn't been encrypted, things like passwords and your location and so on. And so ran some apps on mobile devices on iOS and on Android and found a bunch of location data going out, and a lot of it was unencrypted, showing where I was while I was using the app. And one in particular on iOS, Weather Underground's Wonderground app, was sending out very, very precise lat and long data that let anybody who could have seen my network traffic know exactly where I was. And a lot of news apps do this as well. My local news station's app also send location data. The Fox News app sends a lot of location data and other tracking data. And they use that to monetize in a bunch of different ways. Some applications use it to run ads that are localized to where you are. But in other cases, they sell the data to data monetization firms, or they use those data monetization firms' APIs to provide the location data in the first place. And that's when I talked to Will Strafich at Guardian App, and these guys were doing a look at some of the applications on iOS that were doing this surreptitiously, meaning they don't say they do this in the terms of service or in the description on the App Store, but they're using these different data monetization services, APIs, to get location data. And among them were the big names were like PhotoBucket, MyRadar, and NOAA Weather Radar, like the top two and three, number two and number three free weather apps that were out there. And the worst actor of them all was something called Perfect 365, which is a what they call an augmented reality beauty app. It had 8 different data monetization APIs running in it at the same time. And at one point or another, it had every single one of the firms that are out there. There are about a dozen out there that we track that they had, you know, from version to version, they were switching the data monetization firms they were using.
Wow.
So what you're saying is, I mean, checking the terms of service and seeing, you know, how an app is making money isn't always enough, because they're somehow getting into the app store by not revealing, not being transparent
right.
about what they're collecting.
Right, right. And in fact, a couple of them had been called on it on one point or another. I mean, there was one app that apparently had been caught doing it with one of these APIs, and then they just switched to another the next time they filed a new version to the App Store.
This really reminds me, we talked, I think, a couple of months ago about Google's, the news that I feel like, you know, a lot of people that follow this stuff closely knew for a long time, but, you know, it suddenly burst onto the scene with kind of new revelations that, you know, on the side of Android, that when you turn off location tracking, you're still being tracked in other ways. And a lot of people don't understand
yeah.
that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you go into settings, you take that off, you think mentally as a user, I've done what I need to do to not be tracked. Yet here we are. This is a commonality between platforms, obviously, because a lot of what your research is showing here is that this is going on iOS. How much are the phone makers to blame for this?
Well, the phone makers try to control this, but, you know, a lot of this is based on the permissions you give applications, and sometimes people misuse application permissions for things you wouldn't expect them to.
Yeah.
So, for example, a lot of location data isn't GPS data. It's based on Wi-Fi SSIDs that your phone can see, running it against the location service in back end. It's using Bluetooth low-energy beacons or iBeacons. So, like, when you're in a store or something like that, it can identify what retail establishment you're in. And then there's even just the cell carrier's information itself. Some applications can get a hold of your cell network and the cell tower ID you're hitting. And there are a lot of applications services that pull that data without even really having to have a local app present. They can do it through a website.
So do you know what they're using, these organizations that are buying the data, do you know what they're using it for?
Well, in some applications, they're using it to see when you go to and leave places. There are even some applications for retailers that are called sort of re-enrollment apps, where they find that people who have been in a store and have not come back, they target them with ads to try and get them to come back to a store. So they can have the last date that you arrived at a location and then left. And if you don't come back, they can target you with an ad to try and get you to come back, for example. In other cases, they're doing it to just look at traffic flow. In some stores, they have beacons set up so they can look at how the foot traffic flows through a store. They can do things like target you for the equivalent of customer loyalty programs, where if you have your phone on you and you're using the in-house Wi-Fi, for example, say you go to a Target store or something like that, they're gathering data about you over their Wi-Fi that they have in store, but they're also using antennas within the store to sort of beacon where you are and see what you're looking at.
I think in listening to kind of what you're talking about, obviously there are tons of apps in both app stores, right? iOS app store and Android's app store, the Play Store. And so it's a lot to expect that all of those apps are going to do things in a legitimate sort of way, right? Like, there's always going to be someone that's out to game the system. But I think the way that I'm kind of in this conversation, kind of rethinking about how apps are made, is I always think of apps as being like, this is a really great weather app. Its primary reason for existence is to offer me the weather in a way that I enjoy, or whatever the case may be. When in reality, there are a lot of developers who say, I'm going to make a weather app because it's a really great way to get a feed of this information that's very valuable in other sorts of ways, right? And then there's a lot
right.
of apps that aren't weather apps that have no business getting that location or having any sort of access to it, yet they do that. They exist primarily because they know people are going to say okay and give them the entire fire hose.
Well, exactly. They're also, I mean, think about how often you have a weather app open. You may have a weather app open, and it may be open by default on your phone. If you don't turn your phone off every day,
yeah.
your weather app might still be up, and so it's broadcasting all the time. So even if you're just looking at the weather app for information at that very moment, if it's sitting resident, it could be collecting data on you all the time.
Yeah.
So what's the solution? Is it a mobile VPN, or not to download any apps at all? What can we do?
Well, there's a couple of ways to handle this. I mean, one of them is to, first of all, you know, look at whether these guys have paid apps. That's always a good way to see if they
right.
If they don't run the data acquisition on their paid versions. But you can firewall some of these services off. The folks at Guardian App had a list of these domains that are associated with these services, and you can go in and make settings to block those domains and block location services. You can turn off some advertising settings on the iPhone to limit how much data people can collect. Like there's a specific advertising ID that gets associated with you with your phone. You can turn that off to avoid targeted advertisements. You can turn off, I would recommend turning off Bluetooth and Wi-Fi if you're not attached to a Bluetooth device or your home Wi-Fi. Those cut a lot of these location services out. And yeah, use a VPN when you're out and don't use the in-shop Wi-Fi unless you can help it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to be turning off Bluetooth anytime because how do I use my Apple Watch?
Oh, no, what are you going to
well,
do?
Well, there you go. I mean, that's really what it comes down to is, you know, it's how much is it convenient to you to do any of these things? I mean, we all give away a lot of data about ourselves every time we interact with people. So the question is, how much are you comfortable with? I mean, what is the real threat vector from you giving away this information, these services? It's different if you're like, you know, really, really concerned about privacy and being tracked, then you might want to do these things and not you have an Apple Watch to begin with. But if you are less concerned with having your privacy protected from advertisers and from marketers, and you accept that as part of your daily life, then hey, you're fine. You just leave your Bluetooth on and have your Apple Watch and have ads delivered to your Apple Watch.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Sean is the IT and National Security Editor at Ars Technica. He's a former Navy officer, systems administrator, and network systems integrator. He is also the Pack Rat on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming
on. Packet Rat.
The Packet Rat. Packet Rat.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, gosh. Do not tweet them. Who is the Pack Rat? I don't know who that is. The Packet Rat, of course.
Beware. It's certainly not Sean.
Well...
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks a lot.
We really appreciate your time.
Take care.
All right. The European Parliament yesterday voted on a new piece of legislation that has online copyright in its sights. And it's been a little controversial, to say the least. The copyright directive was approved yesterday in Parliament, though a final vote will not take place until January 2019. It is expected to pass. Many argue it will significantly change the free flow of ideas in the internet. And joining us to share his take on the copyright directive is Danny O'Brien from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Hey, good to be in.
It's great to have you here. So thank you for joining us. So first of all, the EFF has written about this vote saying Europe, quote, lost the internet, which is a very big statement. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, one of the things that the internet has always sort of benefited from is that it's kind of a permissionless environment. If you wanted to set up a website or build a service, you didn't have to go and ask someone permission to do that. And this really majorly changes that kind of setup. So basically, there's lots of things in this regulation, some good, some terrible. But the one we've mainly been talking about is Article 13, which requires services which take uploads from users and then put them online. And it will require those services to effectively filter everything for copyright infringements before they go up. But really only the kind of infringements that a computer algorithm could detect. So that means that most of the actual piracy will go through fine because they can get around those kind of algorithms. But stuff like fair use, stuff like parodies, things like remixes, stuff that has music playing in the background, as I actually have right now, those would be automatically blocked. Hmm. Unless you go and strike a deal with the license holders. And so that means that if you wanted to run one of these services, you'd have to strike deals. And for everybody else who might serve you a copyright notice, you'll have to block that content.
So the idea is that they will be serving the content creators by doing this. Is there any way in which that is true?
So I'm probably, you know, I'm going to give you our point of view, but our point of view is based on like 20 years having this discussion about copyright, where rights holders are very worried about the internet because people copy things on the internet. And And our explanation is, well, you can't stop people copying things on the internet. That's what it does. You know, when you cut and paste, that's what happens. And in fact, there are lots of ways in which artists benefit from that. In fact, like the huge explosion in music, in remixes, in YouTube culture, all of that came from technologies that the rights holders tried to ban. So in this situation, what they're sort of doing is their assumption is if they force the tech companies to create these huge walls, then the tech companies will somehow pay them to take the walls down. Of course, it's artists who are on the other side of that wall. It's artists who are trying to get their content online, and it's everybody else on the internet who isn't part of this ongoing battle who ends up suffering.
Hmm. Now, there were parts of the proposal that the EU rejected flat out.
Right.
What were some of those? How were they representative of this whole story of copyright in kind of the modern digital age?
So what we're trying to do, and actually how this directive started up, was to try and see if we could fix copyright, see if we could take some of the stuff that really wasn't panning out and put some sort of fixes in place. So a good example of this is, well, okay, if suddenly these algorithms are going to wipe out memes, as the meme went, then maybe we can create a copyright exemption in the same way as we have copyright exemptions for research purposes or educational purposes. So there was one clause that said, okay, user-generated content, like memes, has a particular exemption. That was voted down. Another example of this is that there are some old laws on the books in many countries in Europe that say if you take a photograph of a public statue or you're in a public place, you have to pay a license fee to the architects who made that statue in the first place, which means basically any photograph you take of yourself or a selfie in public that has something in the background, technically you could be sued for infringement. Now, that never really used to matter because people would take photos for themselves. But now, because they're uploading them onto these services, or they're using those pictures on Wikipedia, or, you know, just using it to brighten up their blog, all of those people who are infringing could be sued and would be blocked by these filters. So Wikipedia particularly pressed for a right of panorama, which a lot of countries have, which is an exemption. That was voted down. And the stuff that got voted up, it's kind of insane. There's like an extra clause that was dropped in the last minute that made the organizers of sports events the blanket owner with no exemptions of any material that came out of that. So now, technically, not only are your selfies in front of public buildings infringing, any photo or anything you take in of a sports event in Europe could also be blocked as well. So we've always been arguing, you know, what we need with copyright in the digital era is a bit of a light touch, and Europe has doubled down on copyright isn't working, so we're going to like force all of these extra rules until we manage to work out a way of extracting money from it.
You talked a little bit about the algorithms that might be able to recognize copyrighted content and all of it that it wouldn't be able to recognize. Are there any technical, can you talk at all about the technical solutions that they claim will help here?
Well, the irony here is that I think that that one of the reasons why this passed in Europe is because Europeans and particularly EU politicians are super mad at Google and super mad at Facebook. And someone, you know, understandably, right? They're foreign companies. They now dominate a lot of the communication. They don't pay all the taxes they'd like them to pay. They mess, you know, there's many reasons why they're understandably mad. But this algorithmic solution to this problem is something actually Google's been touting for some time. At the beginning of YouTube, when YouTube was being sued by rights holders, and they were actually basically trying to stop YouTube, in order to moderate that and fend that off, Google introduced this thing called Content ID. Now, you will know it better as the thing that randomly deletes videos off YouTube because there's music playing in the background, or you've accidentally played Bach, and Sony claims all the copyright on Bach performances. It's not a good solution. But it's something that the rights holders felt might work. One of the reasons why it's not a solution is you can kind of do this like image audio detection sort of Shazam style on these things. But it can't recognize fair use, right? If I put up a clip of Donald Trump that's owned by NBC, say, that's going to go down, right? Because it matches the image. If I'm putting up a video of Trump because I want to criticize Trump or I want to criticize NBC's coverage of Trump, that's perfectly legal in the EU and here. But you can't teach in AI politics. And believe me, at the EFF, if we could, we'd probably have just left it to them.
can't teach in AI politics yet.
I'm not sure we want the politics that an early 0.1 version of AI or that the European governments want.
Yeah.
The irony is they just introduced another law at the same time as this one that wants to use algorithms to find and remove terrorist encouraging content within an hour.
Right. That was yesterday, news yesterday, right. I believe, right?
Same thing. It's like, we have a problem here. Something must be done. This is something. Let's do it.
Wow. So you mentioned, or rather the post, I think the post was Cory Doctorow, right? EFF, which was a very good piece, very worth the read. He points out something that I thought was very poignant. He says, as long as people have problems that intersect with the internet, there will always be calls to break the internet to solve them. And I feel like, you know, now more than ever, we see this time and time again, this is becoming the go-to solution. And, I'm sure you could speak from the EFF perspective as far as just how much the things seem to have ramped up around this point. Are you hopeful at this point that this kind of tendency to break things can be overcome, or are we hitting kind of this critical mass point where it just seems to everyone apparently that this is the only way to fix things?
Well, you always have to be optimistic in this situation. Sure. We've gone through a long period where the internet was suggested as the solution to all problems. And at the EFF, we spent a lot of time going, you know, there's these downsides. Surveillance will be a problem. Yeah. Privacy will be a problem. And so now where the pendulum has swung again, my hope is that people start realizing the damage before they pass the laws. Yeah. And one of the good things about this is it's going to take a while to implement. There are a couple more votes to go through. And the way the EU works is that individual nation states, state member states, have to implement this in their own law afterwards. So there's an opportunity for the first countries to realize the consequences of this. And there's possibilities for the courts to realize this and step in. So yeah, I am confident as long as, you know, government doesn't run ahead of itself. And I think the problem right now is because everyone's panicking slightly and because you get brownie points for doing something, as I say, the regulators are running ahead of themselves.
Yeah. Well, Danny O'Brien, it's been a pleasure bringing you on today. We really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this important issue. Everybody should definitely look up the EFF post that we're talking about in this interview, and just really, really appreciate your time. Where do you want people to follow you online if they want to follow your independent vote or opinions online?
Oh, me? Yeah. Well, I always recommend people following Corey, who's all over the internet. I'm Mala on Twitter, but I very rarely talk about these things. And I'm also Mala on Mastodon. So mastodon.social. So if that's probably where I talk about those things. Right. And you can, of course, follow Twitter, follow EFF on twitter.com/EFF.
Right on. Danny, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good evening.
After the break, new iPhones for everyone. And there's even a cheap one that starts at $749. Cheap. Get it? Not cheap. We'll get Jason Snell's thoughts on the announcements. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Cashfly. Do you remember the last time you were woken up at 3 a.m. with frantic phone calls because your CDN experienced another outage? and dreading opening your email and finding hundreds of complaints from users? With unreliable tech support, every second your site is down is money being lost on your watch. Being the one to answer the tough questions about your CDN coverage is no picnic, especially when you can't even predict your own CDN costs because of unpredictable usage-based bills. Make the switch. CashFly has been building trusted CDN relationships since 2002. CashFly eliminates CDN outages, helps customers reach new markets, and controls costs for all of their customers. They guarantee 100% availability with their bulletproof 100% SLA, supported by an expert team of smart, easy-to-talk-to, and agile techs that can answer all your questions the first time. And they never pass you around to five different departments. They don't pass you around to three different departments. They answer your questions the first time. If you're in software, podcasting like me, it's hard to predict bandwidth consumption for the month. Even worse, it's super frustrating when companies try to lock you into a contract that's not flexible and not built around your demand and your unique traffic patterns. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week, or worse, even daily, trying to track your CDN usage. On average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. Just imagine what you could do with that 20% and your time, that time you get back when you don't have to micromanage your usage or worry about having to commit to long contract based on a growth plan that you didn't even write. That is a crazy way to buy CDN. As Leo has told us time and again, we've been hosting all our podcasts, our audio, video on CashFly for nearly a decade. And every month you, our viewers and listeners, download petabytes of data fast and flawlessly. Twit would not exist without CashFly. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network and let CashFly give you some sanity back. I have an exclusive offer just for Twit listeners. CashFly is giving away a complimentary, detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and your usage trends. See if you might be leaving that 20% or more on the table. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. That's twit.cashfly.com, and we thank CashFly for their support of Tech News Weekly.
So in case you were living under a buttonless rock yesterday, you know that Apple held its annual and eagerly awaited iPhone event. By the way, is the whole buttonless thing, is that a joke that's like 5 years old at this point? I think it kind of is. you're like, I don't even remember that joke. That's how old it is. And the company announced not one, not two, but three new handsets at their iPhone event, along with an exciting Apple Watch revision. So we reached out to the man who had the chance to spend some hands-on time with them all, Jason Snell, Six Colors, and writing for Macworld with his hands-on. Those hands on all those devices. Welcome to the show, Jason. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, fellow Jason. It's good to be here.
Yes, good to have you. So before we get to your thoughts on all that hardware, obviously you were at the event. Any true surprises to you? Were you happy with the presentation, how it was all laid out in front of you? Any weird moments? What did you think?
I got to say, the only surprise at this event is that somehow the people who run Apple's web servers don't keep unannounced products off the server so people can find out about them in advance. We right. got two leaks. We got some image leaks back 2 weeks ago. That was literally somebody guessing based on their URL pattern from previous events. And then the sitemap apparently for the store got updated, where somebody was not aware that if you update something in this system, it pushes out a file over here and the public can read that file, and somebody was watching. And so as a result, were there any really big surprises at the event? No, because Apple's own internal kind of like digital files were leaking out. But it was a good event. It's nice to be in that theater. It's a beautiful facility. And on that campus, it's like the only time they let people who are not of the body onto that campus. That's an old Star Trek reference. Anyway, it is. So it's nice to go there because it is beautiful, and the trees and grass and stuff are growing in. And it is literally a facility built for events like this one.
Wow. Awesome. Well, someday maybe I'll go there and actually get to see if those rocks are buttonless. Let's start with the phones. There's the iPhone XS, XS Max, XR. Although I want to say XS, the entire time.
I was going to compliment you on your proper pronunciation of these ridiculous
he
names.
He has it written down.
Now, let me just say, I have it actually written out in words so that I wouldn't mess it up. That's the only way I can do it properly. So all different sizes, all different price points. Thanks for pointing that out, Megan. I knew you would appreciate that. Which is the one that spoke most to you and why?
I am not a big fan of the giant phones. So the XS is the most interesting to me because I have an iPhone 10 and I like the 10. The other two phones are fascinating because they say something about the smartphone market. The fact is that Apple knows this market and knows who buys iPhones and know who buys phones that aren't iPhones. And this is that thing that Samsung discovered years ago, which is people, when you show them a bigger phone, they say, this is great. Can you make an even bigger one? And so what Apple has done this time for the very first time is released 2 6-inch plus models plus an update to the iPhone 10 that is essentially the small phone now. And of course, keep in mind, the iPhone 10 is larger than the iPhone 6, 7, and 8. So, you know, Apple doesn't, if you want a phone smaller than the iPhone 10 that's new, that's an iPhone, you can't get one. They'll sell you one from the last few years, but they that's all we got.
And will they still sell you the SE? I'm kind of mourning the loss of the iPhone SE. Are you?
Yeah, it's they say contact, I forget what the phrasing they use, but essentially it's, well, we made all of them. They're done. maybe you could find one out there somewhere. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility that there will be an iPhone SE again at some point. In fact, I wonder if this, as the iPhone 7 and 8 push down the price list, it wouldn't shock me if in a year or two there was a new iPhone SE that was essentially the iPhone 8, but with some upgraded internals, sort of like what they did with the iPhone 5 design. But as for that small design in particular, I don't know. I kind of feel like it's gone, because not because there aren't people who don't love it, but because they are such a small group, and Apple really is betting on the fact that people, if given the choice between a smaller phone and a larger phone, will generally choose a larger phone, to the point where their lowest priced new phone is a large screen phone, which has never happened before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. What about features within these handsets? You know, every time there's a revision, there's got to be a couple of new features. It could be software, that could be hardware, but what are some standout features that you are really looking forward to?
Well, you know, this is an S year, and despite the weirdness of it, they have been tacking an S on to the names of iPhones for a long time, since the iPhone 3GS, the third one they made. So it is an S year, which means there's not as much new stuff. If you remember all the stuff they dumped into that iPhone 10 last year, it really was a huge change for them. Mm-hmm. And this year, it's smaller stuff. It's kind of funny. A lot of their storyline is about very specifically tying it to the A12 processor, which is this first 9-nanometer process, 7-nanometer process. I forget. Yeah, it is like they're bragging on their chip design and on the fab that they're contracting to use it. It's a fancy chip. And the most impressive thing in it is that they I think they realized that they needed to shift their machine learning stuff into gear, that Google was really so strong in that area that they needed to find any advantage they could, and they're really good at making custom chips. And so the A12 has this 8-core machine learning subprocessor inside of it, and that's going to allow them, the sales pitch is, there are all sorts of features that are enabled by having all of that power that they didn't used to have. Photography is the best example. They've wired in the image signal processor that they use. They made a whole big pitch for computational photography, the idea that it's not just about having a good sensor, having a good lens, but it's about the software and hardware on the back end that can do some intelligent things that you don't know that they're happening, but they're happening. And the best example, and honestly, the feature that I'm most excited about, is this smart HDR feature, where they said they're taking, I liked how they explained it too. It's like, when you take a picture, we take 4 pictures, but we don't just take 4 pictures. We also take 4 more intermediate pictures, and we take a long exposure. And then we analyze all of this with machine learning. And from that, we build a single image that has high dynamic range, that has, you know, they're getting shadow detail, they're getting bright details, and they're picking all of these best elements in all of these different image captures. And then in the end, they just say, oh, here's a picture, and this doesn't look great. But that's compelling. I think people will pay for a good smartphone camera. And let's also keep in mind, most people aren't upgrading from the iPhone 10 or the iPhone 8. They're upgrading from a phone that's 2 or 3 or 4 years old. So for them, they're getting, you know, it's much more than just, we focus so much on what's new from last year. Mm-hmm. Most smartphone buyers aren't buying a replacement for last year's model.
What do you make of, last year was a weird year, I mean, for tech journalists or people who buy all the iPhones so they can talk about them and pretend they're tech journalists like me. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about me. Where they came out with the iPhone 8 and then a month or two later, they came out with the iPhone 10. But this year they're doing it oppositely so that the super expensive high end one comes out first, followed by the lower end cheaper version. What do you make of that switch?
I think it's as simple as the fact that anytime Apple makes a brand new model and the iPhone XR is brand new technology, it's a new screen, you know, the 10 technology they've already got down, but the XR, I think they just, you know, got delayed in building it and they didn't want one XS out there without the other XS, the large iPhone XS Max, right? They wanted those out there together. And I really think it's that simple, is that sometimes they can't make enough of them. They have some production delays. And I think that's what's going on with the XR, is that I bet you anything they tried to get it to ship this week or next week and they just couldn't do it. So everybody's going to have to wait a month for that. And, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it is... You know, one of the fascinating questions about this entire event is who buys the XR and who buys the XS Max? There's $350 difference between those two phones. And although, you know, the XS Max is great, it's a little bit bigger. It is sort of a 3X, so it's got much higher density screen than the, and it's got two cameras compared to the XR, but it's also $350 more expensive to start. And then, of course, you can take it up from there and put 512 gigs in it. And now it costs almost $1,500. So I think it's going to be an interesting question. I think Apple expects they'll sell more XS Maxes because they'll feel like people who buy these iPhones just want the best. Give me the best and then I'll use it for a while. But I don't know. Like, it's going to be really interesting to see what the – or try to guess, because Apple will never say. But try to guess how well these three different models sell, because the XR is a new attempt for them to get something – You know, I can't say it's cheap. It actually costs what the old iPhone Plus models cost. Mm-hmm. And if you want to look at it this way, you could say this is the first time, or this is the most expensive, lowest price for a brand new model Apple has done on the iPhone. That they don't have something like the 8 that's new that fits that price slot. The 8's still there and you can get it for cheaper. But like the iPhone XR is not cheap. It's just the cheapest of the three. They're all... you know, fairly expensive phones. And this has been a strategy that Apple's had, which is to just kind of keep ratcheting up the average selling price of every iPhone. And last year they were able to do this. It's almost like a little magic trick where last year they brought in the 8 at the normal prices and then the 10 really expensive. And then this year they said, well, we also have this new XR, but the 8 just kind of like they didn't replace the 8 with anything. There was no iPhone 9. And that is, you know, that has the net effect of raising the price of the iPhone if you want a current model.
And then finally, what about the Apple Watch 4? Obviously, this was a big redesign, actually. I think you mentioned it was the biggest design change since the beginning of the device. What did you think of the changes under the hood, kind of the different look to the device? What were your thoughts?
I got to be honest. I think this was the most interesting product in some ways because it is the first real design iteration there. The hardware's really grown up. It's been 4 years since the Apple Watch was introduced, announced. It didn't even ship until about 3.5 years ago. And it's got that big screen. It's compatible with all the existing watch bands, but the much bigger screen, it's going all the way out to the edges. It's got kind of curved edges instead of being a little rectangle in the center with, you know, you couldn't see it, but with big bezels under the glass there. And that's going to change how app developers write for it. They added all of these new complications, including ones where there's a big stretch that, you know, that the app developers can use. I think it's all to the good. And I think it's all motivated by the fact that 4 years ago, Apple didn't know what this product was. The intro 4 years ago was sort of like a list of all the things you could possibly theoretically do with the Apple Watch. And it was unclear like what Apple thought people would do with it. I think they didn't know. And in this event, it's very clear that Apple has boiled everything about the Apple Watch down to three things, which is communication, health, and fitness. And everything is meant to serve those three ideals. And that's good. I mean, they seem kind of obvious, but go back and watch that presentation 4 years ago, they had no idea. It was to hang out with your friends. It was to send people little heartbeats. It was all this weird stuff. It was like when you asked Apple 4 years ago what the Apple Watch did, their response was, well, what doesn't it do? And now their answer is going to be communication, health, and fitness. And all the features kind of are aligned with that. And as a result, yeah, it's a much more coherent product. I think they know what they want it to be. And adding something like an electrocardiogram built in, which, you know, a lot of people who are cardiologists are like, wait a second, am I going to be besieged by my patients getting false readings from the Apple Watch or something? We don't really know. But it has the potential between that and like the fall detection. I heard a lot of people say, oh, my God, I could buy one of these for, an aging parent. And basically, if somebody falls and doesn't move for a minute, it calls for help. It's like, that's pretty cool. And if people discover heart problems that they didn't know they had, that's also pretty cool. So, yeah, I think all in all, the Apple Watch kind of figuring out what it wants to be when it grows up was the biggest story of this event.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Jason Snell, sixcolors.com. Also, this article you wrote for Macworld. So if people want to find your hands-on, they can get to it through Six Colors, but also find it on Macworld. Jason, it's a real pleasure to get you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, fellow Jason. And thanks, Megan, too.
Right on. We'll talk to you soon, sir. Bye.
So far, we don't have our flying cars or our jetpacks just yet, but we have the next best thing, stuff that comes straight to us in an emergency. That's the idea behind one startup called Jetpack that helps deliver almost anything to college students on campus. Fatima Diko is an engineer, an entrepreneur, and founder of Jetpack. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
We've been trying to get you on for a while. You have a great startup story. Let's start with just a little bit of your background. You grew up in New York, but where were you before that?
Right. So I was born in Mali. A lot of people may not know, but Timbuktu is there. I was born in Mali, came to New York City when I was 5 years old. And that's when I started learning English. I started watching my dad build computers. Ended up going to Columbia in the city as well. And then, you know, my journey began from there.
So what do you remember about your dad building PCs? What are your memories of that?
So I remember seeing a motherboard for the first time, and I was so intrigued. I had never seen a piece of hardware like that before. I was so inquisitive. I was asking so many questions about how it fit into the larger CPU, which at the time was like the size of me as a kid. and it was, as you can imagine, if you know, you come to the United States without learning any English, you're going to have a lot of questions about everything around you. So even things like going to the amusement park, questions started to follow. How does that work? You know, how does the roller coaster get us back down once we're up there? How are you building the computer together? And I think that just started the series of just being a really prolific noticer and one who just asked questions. So I would say that's really where it began.
And I mean, you know, it's not just a matter, it sounds like from your story, not just a matter of noticing how these things work, but then also, you know, as any good entrepreneur has, the curiosity of that stuff, but then the idea to actually take that and implement it. And I mean, this Jetpack is not your first thing, you know, your first project. Right. There's My Best Box as well. Like, I don't know, what do you attribute to your ability to take all that and then have kind of the confidence to then step forward and make it a reality, make it happen?
Yeah, no, that's a really phenomenal question. I had a technical mentor at Procter & Gamble where while I was there, I was on an R&D group of five technologists where we were coming up with products 3 to 10 years away from market. And one of my technical mentors at the time, phenomenal innovator, one of the lead inventors of both Swiffer and Head & Shoulders, he would always say that great ideas happen when two old ideas come together for the first time. And for me, that was really powerful because it reinforced this idea that you do not have to be the most brilliant person or the person to think of something before anyone, you know, thinks of it, but rather notice an inefficiency in one space and then find the solution in another. And, you know, as we were saying about being a noticer and being inquisitive and asking the question why, a lot of that helped me start to just piece things together from different places.
So you were at Procter & Gamble, and then you went to Stanford for graduate school. Is that where you came up with the idea for Jetpack?
Yeah. So actually, I left Procter & Gamble, began working on the idea. My dad at the time, he was like, wait, so you're leaving P&G to sell toothpaste out of backpacks? and I was like, yep, but at scale. And there'll be a mobile app. There'll be all these things. Going to business school essentially bought me 2 years to work on the company while I was there, to get my parents, who are not familiar with the whole entrepreneurial journey, off my back, I guess, for about 2 years. And that's when I really began testing the idea, raising funds, seeing if this could ever have a shot. Did other people want this? Was it just me? And that's how it evolved over time.
So maybe dive a little bit into exactly how Jetpack works, because the idea of like these backpacks filled with like sample sizes for the most part, right? Like it's, you don't always necessarily need a full box, a huge box of Kleenex. Maybe you need a little sample size where you happen to be because you got Kleenex at home. Is that kind of the idea behind Jetpack?
Right. So the way it started, I'm an extremely forgetful person. I forget things all the time, from phone chargers, lint rollers. I'm always texting my friends for last minute products. And when you dive into the largest delivery companies today, the Amazons of the world, the Postmates, you know, you are getting to a point where the only place where they can't benefit from economies of scale is the final mile of delivery. And this is because the person who knows how to park the car, go in the right, find the right dorm, even gain access into the building, will have a competitive advantage on speed. And so the best way to do this is to use the people who are already in your area, give them the products that people need the most, and then essentially create a mobile app that allows people to locate the nearest person with the item that you need. And so we started at Stanford. We gave a few people backpacks. We filled them up with the items that we thought were the most important. And then we created a mobile app that allowed people to input requests. And this was about a year and a half ago. And we knew that we had something when our average delivery time became 7 minutes. So on average, it took us 7 minutes to receive an order, get someone else to accept it, and then bring the item to the person. Where we started to have challenges were knowing what to put in these backpacks. And so we scaled to our second university, which was Johns Hopkins. And the things that were popular at Stanford, things like chewable coffee, which is a real thing, that was our number one selling product.
Wow.
That was not popular at Johns Hopkins. So that essentially allowed us to change to what we're doing today, which is just as exciting, but allows anyone with the mobile app in the immediate vicinity to fulfill the request if they happen to have the product themselves. And so that's essentially what we're doing. We're building out a convenience network, both people and their own stuff, as well as sample size products that we pre-stock to help people gain the items that they desperately need in minutes.
I went to Johns Hopkins, and I'm sad to know that no one chews coffee there. I mean, I was there in 1995, but it seems like they would have evolved.
Was chewable coffee a thing in 1995?
No, and neither, I guess, is it now there. I don't know when they're going to catch up. So I'm glad you clarified, because I know I said in the beginning that it was an emergency. And when in my mind, an emergency, you know, is forgetting your chewable coffee or your toothpaste, really. Not, you know, an emergency like a tornado or something like that. So how many, you're at two schools right now?
So we are currently at six schools, and we're expanding to 20 campuses this fall.
So I put this out on Twitter that I was going to talk to you, and I had a question from Stevie on Twitter, who said, with launching on a campus and starting from scratch every time, how do you get students to sign up and be involved?
That's a really great point. So before, for our first six campuses, we took a very hands-on approach to each campus. So a very, you know, on the ground, handing out free food, getting people to download the app. But that quickly wasn't scalable for us. And so what we essentially did was started a campus ambassador program where there's one director that we hire at each campus. And we essentially give them a playbook of exactly how to go from zero users to 1,000 users on their campus. And essentially lay out the things that worked for us. So things like sending out an email to the different dorm listservs, which is something only the campus director can do because they have the .edu account and they have the ability to actually access these dorm listservs. We tell them exactly the types of events that they can put on place on their campus, whether they're food trucks, t-shirt giveaways, and essentially give people who want the entrepreneurial experience to also just get a taste of what growth looks like. They essentially get paid as well, but we found that the main motivation for a lot of the students who end up becoming directors is an appetite for learning how to acquire users from the ground up.
Hmm. So, another question we got, how do you ensure that your jetpackers are safe? That it's safe to be walking to the store? What kind of like loss management and restocking do you have?
Yeah. And so if you want to sign up to become a jetpacker, first and foremost, you need a .edu school email address. So that's required for you to begin the onboarding process. You then watch a video. If you pass the quiz afterwards, we ship you a backpack with different items. And as you are placing different orders in the or accepting different orders in the mobile account, the different amounts of products will automatically go down. And then from there, you can automatically restock items that you run out of. And we can essentially start to learn more and more about the consumption rates of different products. Obviously, when we were really early, a lot of those were guesstimates. But as we, you know, spend more and more time on campuses, we can figure out how much to put in these backpacks beforehand. And in terms of keeping people safe, as I mentioned, you know, that .edu is very, very important, as well as being in a certain geo-fenced area for the app to work and for you to even get the notification. So this is a very hyper-local approach. We don't want people to go to stores and then come back. This is a, if you happen to have it on you, approach of connecting people fairly quickly.
Oh, that makes sense. So that last mile, I mean, you're right, is really hard. It's hard for Amazon. It's hard for any of these companies. Do you imagine this expanding past college campuses to other places that are hard to reach quickly with emergency items like this?
So there's a lot of elements of campuses that make them attractive for a model like this. The first is obviously a very dense population. So a lot of people in one area who have similar needs and are in close proximity to one another. And when we first picked the campuses where we wanted to launch, we focused on campuses where the stores were pretty far or they closed early and people had limited access to public transportation. So Stanford, for example, freshmen aren't allowed to have cars on campus. And if you think of places outside of campuses, there are many locations that have similar attributes to campuses, whether that's co-working spaces, large apartment complexes. If you think about events, you know, music festivals, marathons, conferences, there's no way, if I'm at a conference, to ask every woman in the area if they have an extra tampon. There's no way to do that, even though it's very likely that people in a given area may have something that you need. And so essentially, we're trying to take the learnings that we're getting from college campuses and focus on campuses for the next 12 to 16 months, but ultimately find other areas where this similar sort of atmosphere and geographic makeup exists as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Fatima Diko is the founder of Jetpack. Where is the best place for people to learn more about it?
Totally. So you can visit our website, www.jtpk.co, or you can follow us on Twitter at Let's Jetpack.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Take care.
Thank you,
awesome.
Fatima.
Thank you.
Appreciate
bye-bye.
It. Best of luck. All right, and finally, file this one away in the fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me category. Google announced yesterday that it's putting its inbox email service to bed for good, effective March 2019. Google launched Inbox as an alternative to Gmail, I think it was around 3 years ago, with a completely different user experience paradigm to Gmail, some innovative time-shifting features. The idea was really to create a mail environment that encouraged Inbox Zero to a certain degree, so you could snooze things away that you can't deal with now so that they're hidden from your eyes, and hopefully that frees up space in your mind as one example, acting on other things now so you can be more efficient as another. Inbox has a layout that, at least to my eyes, I've always found pretty intuitive, pretty uncluttered when compared side by side with Gmail. Even so, Google has continued to bring many of Inbox's core feature set into Gmail. And in many ways, the writing was kind of on the wall, even if I personally refuse to admit it. In the end, all this really does is prove once again, and I swear I never actually learned this for good, but to users of Google products, that absolutely nothing is sacred. When you choose to use something new by Google, you do so knowing that their history and their tendency is to kill its darlings in the name of, honestly, sometimes I can't even tell you what. Rest in peace, Inbox. I will miss you when you're gone. I've actually, in email, like I put out a tweet about this yesterday, and I've had so many people super upset about this. Like, you know, it's your email program. It's what you use on a very daily basis. Some people are just tearing off the Band-Aid now. Are you an email? You were an Inbox user.
I was an Inbox user.
You're not anymore.
No, I'm not. I thank goodness I jumped ship before
yes,
it went down.
You're prepared for yes. this moment, Megan. I'm not prepared.
They used you, Jason.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. You as
I feel
a playground
yes.
for all of their experimental features. but now I use many different programs. But right now I'm mostly Airmail on the desktop, Edison on my iPhone. And Edison does the automatic responses that Gmail, the smart replies. Yeah. That's what they're called. Mm-hmm. So I don't really use smart replies so much when I'm at my desktop or my laptop because I'm settled down. But if I'm just wanting to reply to something quickly, mm-hmm. That's what I use. So yeah. I never loved Inbox on the desktop. It did feel cluttered to me. And I look over my shoulder at your email, which I sometimes do, it looks cluttered.
Oh. Oh, Megan.
I'm just talking about glancing.
My problem with Inbox has been that I always aspire to use it the way it's meant to be, which is that you do go down to mm-hmm. zero. And when you do, you get that awesome sun, mm-hmm. that sun setting mm-hmm. that I only ever actually saw because you used Inbox the right way.
So you were looking at my email, too.
And so you would be like, I remember yeah. one time particularly, you were bragging about the sun. I was like, what are you even talking about? And I looked, I was like, that's what happens.
You've never
Whoa.
Seen the sun.
No, I've never. Like, I'm like, giving Inbox all bleary-eyed. I guess what I mean is in Gmail, there's so many things everywhere. And in Inbox, it's like, there's my email and there's my folders. And that's really it.
You mean like the sidebars of stuff?
Yeah, there's just all these things everywhere. And it's so information dense. And I guess with my email, to a certain degree, I don't need it that dense. Mm-hmm. I want it to just be less extra things and more just my email. And I feel like that's what I get out of Inbox that I don't get out of Gmail.
Yeah, I can understand that. I have been using Inbox and Gmail a little bit because Florence Ion, who we both co-host mm-hmm. with, she insists on communicating through that little chat thing. What's it called?
The chat inside of Gmail?
Yeah.
Or
Hangouts?
Oh, yeah, that would be Hangouts. Yeah.
Is there like a separate Hangout app or do I have to get it through my email?
Well, there's a Hangouts app. If you go to hangouts.google.com, okay. Yeah, you can use that.
And Hangouts isn't part of YouTube?
Welcome to Google. Don't worry. They're going to get rid of YouTube in a couple of years,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. yeah, so I don't know. It's just where I like to meet people where they are. That's my style. So that's where Flo is. And so that's where I am. But I guess I should just download the Hangouts app and then I'll be able to chat on that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All your chats would filter through Hangouts.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I've learned so much today.
I'm still just as confused on what I'm going to do. I have no idea. Well, I'm happy you haven't figured out, though.
Airmail. Have you tried? Is Edison? Is that just on? Let's see. Let's see.
I don't know if Edison is on Google. Android.
They're going to be reading your email. That's how they...
Edison software apps on Play Store. I'm not sure if this is the same thing. Oh, yeah. Edison Mail.
Well, they're going to be reading your email because that's how they do the smart replies.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll look into this and it'll be an app that I can review in the arena and check
Play.
It out because I have to now decide, like, what do I do? I'm so used to using Inbox, but it's going to go away. Do I just tear off the Band-Aid and just do it now, make the switch? Because they're not going to update it anymore. They've already announced that it's dead. Google.
Yeah. But the problem, there's no Edison app on the Mac, if there's a Google Play app, then you can use it on your Chromebook, right?
Yeah.
Or is that not how that works?
No, that's true.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
I could do that. That works here. It doesn't work on my Mac, so whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll have to figure this out. Another thing to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/live. You can always be part of the show if you like by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
We would love it if you subscribed to the show. We'd really appreciate it.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
Thank you.
That's the very least you could do.
Yeah, you'd be doing us a solid.
Yeah, all those things. twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe in any tool that you have. And if you want to tweet at me to recommend an email program that I'm not already using, @MeganMaroney.
You're using them all, it sounds like.
I'm using everyone.
I'm @JasonHowell. Thanks to everyone who helps out. Burke, Jammer B, of course, Josh pushing the buttons. And Colleen was in here earlier. Alex, everyone here helps out with the show, and we really appreciate it. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.